thank you so much for taking the time to join us for this Planet Talks discussion on a really interesting question that we'll be dissecting over the course of the next hour as to whether seaweed can save the world. Before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge that Worm Adelaide is held on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. I'd also like to acknowledge the Environment Institute as a presenting partner of today and support too of the Bob Horton Prime Ministerial Centre for this session as well. My name's Nikolai Bailharts. I wake up a lot earlier than you do because I present the breakfast program on ABC Radio Adelaide from 6 until 9 in the morning with Stacey Lee. I've been with the ABC for 17 years and have spent the majority of my time working with the rural department, so with farming, fisheries and forestry as well. So this has been a question that's been around for quite some time. So I'm really interested in hearing from our speakers today about this topic of the role that seaweed can play in ways that you probably don't think. So to introduce our panel, Alice Jones works at the University of Adelaide as a senior lecturer in resilience ecology. Her work focuses on looking at opportunities to try and reduce climate change by studying nature. So we're looking at things like how coastal ecosystems are managed, but also looking at the marine aquaculture side of things as well. Professor Katrina McLeod is currently the Executive Director at the Institute for Marine and Antarctic Studies at the University of Tasmania and leads the Sustainable Marine Resources Program with the Marine Bioforest CRC, which is based at Flinders Inn here in Adelaide. She's got more than 30 years in experience in environmental impact assessment and in the past year has been focusing increasingly in seaweed research as well, looking at how it underpins marine ecosystems as an indicator of health. And finally, Steve Mellor from CH4 Global. He spent many years working in Silicon Valley and elsewhere as an entrepreneur. He's created and scaled products and capabilities that have made in excess of $20 billion in bottom line profit and has now turned his attention, at least in part, to commercialising a particular kind of seaweed as a feed additive, which is something that we'll get into very soon. So we'll be having a pretty casual conversation to cover a whole lot of ground over the course of the next hour. We'll have some time for questions at the end, so if there is something that's burning in your mind, keep it there and you will hopefully have an opportunity to put it to the panel before we finish up. Now, when you think of seaweed, I imagine you probably think of something like this. And for those of you who are up the back who can't quite see it, it's sushi nori. They're the sushi, the seaweed that rolls around your sushi. That's probably the way that a lot of us, the primary way that we interact with seaweed. But as you're about to find out, although sushi is delicious, there are probably, arguably, some more important ways that seaweed may affect you in the future. And sushi as well. Don't worry, sushi's not going anywhere. So I think in the interest of starting at a very basic point, let's start with seaweed and what it is. Alice, it's one of the things that caught me when I was thinking about this is the actual meaning of the word. You know, weed is in it.
Which yeah, it's kind, a bit that, derogatory, isn't
yeah,
it?
It almost points to our historical collective use of looking at seaweed and thinking, nothing but that.
Yeah, it has got a bit of a bad rap, and yeah. A lot of people will be familiar with seeing piles of it on the beaches, which might be a bit smelly, might have, you know, some critters living in it. So I think it probably does have a bit of a bad reputation, but seaweed is essentially the plants of the ocean. So they're not all officially plants, so I have to say that. So plants and algae, and they grow underwater and they perform the same functions underwater as plants and trees and grasses and all sorts of things do on land. So they kind of form the forests of the ocean. And they're really important ecosystems. So not only do they grow into these kind of forests and turfing rocky ecosystems, but also they support lots of other species. So they form habitats that support fish and crustaceans and other invertebrates. And so they're very, very important and they're the primary producers of the ocean. So like plants on land, they use carbon dioxide and sunlight to produce energy, and that's how they grow. And then they form the base of a lot of the food chains in the ocean. So everything else feeds off of those plants in the ocean and they sustain everything else that lives in the ocean, as well as phytoplankton, I should say, as well. So that's the tiny little plants that float around in the ocean. They're important in the food chain as well.
And the variety is something that people might not realise, just how many different kinds, different sizes, different shapes, all that kind of stuff.
yeah, they come in lots of different shapes and sizes, and I think that Katrina's probably in a good position to take that question on.
Yeah, they do. It very much like plants on land, you get underwater forests, so kelp, some kelp on me. Kelp, it can grow really quickly, 10, 15, 20, 30 meters tall, and you can imagine the different forms of life that would be sustained in that, as compared to maybe some of the seaweed equivalents of savannas and plains. And they're all there in the marine environment. Seaweed can be very diverse. We're talking about the functionality,
yeah.
But that's the other issue with it. Because you have these very different types of ecosystems, as Alice talked about in habitats, they actually perform very different roles in the oceans. And the species that rely on them for food and shelter can be very, very different. And so if we lose some of our seaweeds, you can have quite catastrophic effects to other species. And some of you might have actually heard the consequences of some of that around Australia, particularly when we've gone to things like urchin barrens, where we've lost that seaweed cover, and you're ending up with basically deserts in the ocean. So they are very important for a whole range of purposes, and we need to look after them.
And that is almost where climate as a broad issue starts to come in as well, when those habitats start to become lost. And Steve, that kind of ties in with your particular interest in a particular kind of seaweed, Asparagopsis.
So, yeah, we work on Asparagopsis. There are actually two species of it. They're red seaweeds. There are reds, greens, and browns. These are two particular variants in a red species family. One that likes to grow in slightly warmer waters, and one that likes to grow in slightly cooler and waters. Australia is unique in the sense that both species are actually native to Australia. And frankly, South Australia is unique, is that both species grow on the same plot of land. At different times, there's a seasonality to them to do with water temperatures and currents and nutrient flows and a variety of other things. But there is a uniqueness associated with it there. All seaweeds are known to produce a variety of volatile materials, bioactives, as part of their normal metabolic processing. This particular species is the only one that's been found today. Probably there are some others, but it's the only one that's been found today that stores and concentrates these bioactives inside of the plant. And it's used it for millennia as a defense mechanism. And when they're stored in that level of concentration, a marine species comes up, nibbles on the plant, and says, yeah, I don't like that. It's a beautiful Christmas tree, reddish, purplish structure, flowing in currents. It looks gorgeous, and so very attractive to a marine species to come up to. And about 10, perhaps 11 or 12 years ago, the initial observations by then a Canadian scientist who was recruited and came and joined CSIRO in Townsville and worked with folks at James Cook University, and then subsequently with Meat and Livestock Australia, really uncovered the mechanism behind what was happening. And they found, amongst all seaweeds, they sampled a couple of dozen off of the Great Barrier Reef and set them up in an artificial cow stomach model to see what it did to the production of methane. And some of them had effects, 10% reduction, maybe even 20%. But Asparagopsis completely shut down methane production at very small amounts, not large amounts. And in fact, in a cow, a beef feedlot cow that might eat 10 kilos of feed a day, or a dairy cow that might eat 20 or more kilos of food a day, it's less than 0.5% of this seaweed. We dry it in some appropriate ways to preserve these bioactives, but you can imagine 2 tablespoons sprinkled in 10 kilos of food. So it's a very small amount to have this potent effect of 80% to more percentage of a reduction in methane in those animals.
And so can we put into context why methane is of concern?
So I'll take one step back and talk about carbon. Carbon dioxide. So we've focused on reducing carbon dioxide, primarily from fossil fuels. You know, they're the big bad actor in this. Let's get that reduced in here. And in 2015 in Paris, at when all of the countries meet typically every year, although COVID missed one of those, at COP, Conference of the Parties 21, there was a fairly historical and pivotal agreement amongst almost all of the countries in the world. At that stage, Australia did not sign up to it, but has more recently, which says CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere are too high. They're rising at an alarming rate, much more so than we've ever seen historically. And that's a problem. We need to get them down. And so there was a lot of work done by thousands of climate scientists to say, what do we need to get it down to? And it came up with, we need to reduce it somewhere around 47% from where it is. And this was in 2015. So fast forward 8 years to where we are now, hasn't gone down at all. We've made no progress on that single endpoint. And that is the single endpoint that we agreed as a planet, as the citizens of this planet, or at least the politicians representing us, was the single measure of our role and impact on climate change. That greenhouse gas is one of the primary ones doing that. Now, in last year's COP meeting, there was a couple of important things that happened. I think a recognition that we can't get where we need to get as a society on reducing carbon dioxide. We've failed in 8 years. We're not gonna get there in the next seven. 2030 is the key date to achieve that by. Despite what all countries say they're going to offer up, I could offer up I'm going to the moon tomorrow too, but it's not really going to happen. So we have to get realistic about this. And what happened at that last COP was they said, well, look, methane's rising actually at a greater rate. It's also 86 times more impactful than carbon dioxide. And it comes really from only a couple of key sources that we produce. There are natural sources that happen in wetlands, but that we are responsible for. And they, you know, oil and gas happens to be one of those, and there's a lot of work going on to say, how do we close up the pipelines from leaky, because natural gas is methane. So that's one area, and that's been the focus, but it's not the largest, but the single largest source of anthropogenic, that which we cause methane, are cows birthing. And the impact of that, just to dimension that for you in here, the total amount from the 1.5 billion cows on the planet is greater than the total greenhouse gas output of the entire country of China. Entire country of China, it's 25 times more than the total country of Australia. It's the United States plus the EU27 plus India plus Russia, the numbers 2, 3, 4, and 5 emitters combined. So it's incredibly powerful and incredibly impactful, and it only stays around for 12 and a half years. It breaks down to carbon dioxide, which lasts for hundreds, if not thousands of years on its impact. So if you could reduce it, you actually have not only the opportunity to reduce greenhouse gases in the next few years, but actually there's been a lot of work done that says that could actually result in a cooling, perhaps even up to half a degree in the next few years, given we've risen 1.1 degree from the baseline. So it's an incredibly important, impactful area. We focus on what happens in those cows and how do we mitigate that methane, but in the dimension of the problem, that's, you know, that's the magnitude of it.
And that's where the role of your hope, Spherogopsis, can come in to reduce that.
So the problems with most seaweeds is how do you grow them at large scale to have large impact? And you know, aquaculture is certainly one of those. Much of the fish that the world eats today comes from aquaculture, as will be true for seaweeds. Many of them that need to be grown. You know, there are 8 billion of us on the planet today, and so we need food and ingredients and agriculture that can have broader impact. So aquaculturing this particular species is actually pretty difficult. It has a very complex life cycle, a multi-phase one. We can chat afterwards if you'd like. But it's not only about how do you understand the life cycle so you can propagate the species, how do you grow it? Well, where do you grow it? How do you do it at large scale? And importantly, how do you do that in a way where it's profitable? Because if it doesn't make any profit, no one's going to give you any money to go and build large scale. It actually has to achieve pretty significant profits. And then when you've grown it, if you've managed to get that far, now you need to process it effectively to remove most of the water. You don't need to ship water around, towers don't need that extra bulk. So how do you do that where you preserve these bioactives that are inside of the seaweed? And then how do you formulate it for different types of cows? Feedlot cows are very different than dairy cows in how and what they consume, as they're very different from beef grazing cows. And they require different types of product forms in these supplement areas. So that's what we do. We currently have operations in South Australia, over on the Eyre Peninsula, and in New Zealand. It's actually a US company, and that's simply because I live in the US for 35 years, and I can raise substantial amounts of money from the investment community in there, having lived in the middle of Silicon Valley. And I mean tens of hundreds of millions of dollars to invest in that. It's just simply not available to do within Australia's investment community. And so, but wholly owned subsidiary in Australia and in New Zealand, they're the operating facilities. We're building the next scale commercial facility now. We introduced last year the first commercial products into some feedlot systems with a commercial partner here in South Australia. And so validation of what we're building now from a financial profitable piece will allow us, with some partners that we're building who write $200 million minimum checks, to build a large infrastructure scale. So that's the critical piece that actually is required for any, you know, food or impact on climate change. It just doesn't happen if you can't make profit.
Does add a really interesting complexity to the problem. I thought that was me. Because the potential in this species to solve what is one of those wicked problems for us also comes with the issue that Steve talked about, that if it's to be successful, given the cows, the number of cows we're talking about, it has to happen at scale. And so that means intensive seaweed production. And that in itself comes with some issues and complexities. And that's why conversations like this are so important, because we have to look at the big picture, the end game of what we're looking to achieve. But along the way, there's a whole load of other little issues that we have to tackle as a society and work out, you know, how comfortable we are with that. To produce that at scale in water will mean significant areas of coastal resource being provided for this. Fortunately, with asparagopsis, so you can actually grow it in water, but in the coastal systems, although there's some complexities with that, but also on land. But that starts to have really interesting public debates about how we use our coastal resources, our water, our land, and the intensification of some of those production systems. I'm just flagging that because that is a really important conversation for us to have. Because when we start dealing with some of these big issues that we've got to deal with, getting to the solution can raise a whole load of other issues that we have to work through as scientists, as industry, as government, but also as a community. And I really love the fact that we can have these kind of conversations and debates. Getting the information out there, the understanding out there, the transparency out there is really critical to that.
Climate aspect of this, one of the other sides in terms of trying to reduce emissions, one of the other sides that's been talked about is the potential for capturing carbon in seaweed. Else, is that, where do we sit with that idea?
Okay, so just a bit of background. We talked about how seaweed is a photosynthetic organism, so they basically use carbon dioxide from their environment. In the case of seaweed, usually it's dissolved in the water and they take it up and they use it with light to make their tissues, so to grow. And so as a result of that, they're taking in carbon from the environment and locking it away in their tissues. So they're definitely a carbon pool, we call it, in the global carbon cycle. So carbon is cycling through seaweeds all the time because they need carbon to grow and they build it into their tissues as they grow. The thing with climate change mitigation is that you need sequestration. So sequestration is when the carbon is locked away over thousands of years, ideally. Sometimes it's defined as hundreds of years. So with a tree on land, you could potentially say if you grow a tree, that is true sequestration because the tree might live for longer than 100 years. Most seaweeds have a higher turnover. They don't live for those kind of time frames. And so any carbon that goes into seaweed is then broken down again when the seaweed dies, or it gets passed to another organism when it gets eaten by a fish, for example. And so it's not true sequestration. So I think that there's a little bit of either misunderstanding or worst case greenwashing when people talk about the potential for seaweed as a kind of like a climate change mitigator in that direct way. But like Steve has been talking about, there's really good indirect ways that seaweed can have an effect on climate change. So it might not be a sequesterer of carbon directly, but it can be used to offset emissions from other industries, so like from cattle farming. It can be used as a biofuel, it can be used as a bioplastic. You know, there's all these other ways that it can be used as a replacement for something that would have a greater emissions footprint if you used the other thing, like petrol or diesel or whatever. So it's not directly taking carbon in the long term out of the atmosphere, but it can be used to offset carbon in other industries. And I think we also need to think not just about its potential to draw carbon out of the environment and sequester it, so store it for long time periods, but also what's the risk if we lose all of our seaweed ecosystems? Because they do hold a lot of carbon, and if they die en masse, all of that carbon, it breaks down and gets re-released back to the atmosphere. So we need to protect them to prevent that happening at a large scale, because they store millions of gigatons of carbon. Just, it might be turning over quite quickly, but if they die, that all comes out in one big go and gets released eventually back to the atmosphere. So so it's not just about the sequestration potential, which is, I think, people might want to argue with me about it, but I think quite low, but it's about protecting what is already stored in their tissues and stopping them from being affected by, you know, human impacts or climate change, such that they might just completely die off and then we lose all the carbon that is in their tissues.
So this whole topic of sequestration is an important one, and as is the whole field of post-seaweed, but climate change, which is where I spent a lot of my time, it's an incredible amount of misinformation and disinformation. So let me give you some of the facts around sequestration. There isn't any viable sequestration going on the planet today. Doesn't matter what you've heard. There are large machines that are actually quite costly. Several have been built in different parts of the world. The prototypical one is in Iceland, where it draws all of its energy from geothermal in here. And operating at full tilt for it takes out the amount of carbon from about 300 cars. It cost them $25 million to be able to build it in here. It's not scalable. The concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, while low, is too low to be able to take it directly out of the atmosphere, based on current today's technology. The way people talk about it today is really a little bit of a, it's a bit harsh, but maybe a greenwashing approach for the oil and gas industry. Oh, God, there's about 11 terms now that are green something or other, but they all mean tricking you into believing that there's an impact when there isn't an impact on something. In this case, my product might have a claim on the outside of it that you pick up at the supermarket, and it's just not true when you dig in.
Or over-emphasizing it.
Yeah.
Overstating it as well.
And as I said, it's intended basically to trick you into believing something and purchasing something or voting for something or doing something in the guise that it's good for you and good for the planet, when that's fundamentally not true. Today, the only place carbon sequestration is actually generating value is by injecting CO2 back down oil and gas wells. And it's sequestered in the place where you've taken them out from, so you inject it back down and you force more oil and natural gas out of that well. So that continues to propagate the utilization of natural gas and fossil fuels, which we have to wean ourselves off of over time. And that's a viable way to do it, but it's not having the intended consequence. And you go back to what I said before. It's publicly available and widely talked about. What is the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere year on year? Since we've started measuring it, I think going back to 1957. And it goes up on an annual 2.9% increase rate. Hasn't changed. The only time it changed and deflected downwards was in 2020 in COVID, when effectively the world shut down. We used dramatically less energy, and energy in the form of fossil fuels, and it went down about, depending upon how it's measured, between 3 and 4%. Not the 47% that's required in the next now 7 years, but it rebounded not only to recover that loss, but more than that in a post-COVID world. And last year it continued to go up, and that will continue to happen. So despite all of the electric vehicles and battery storage and the $2 trillion that have been spent on the alternative energy sector to date around the world, which is all good for a transition, but it's made no difference to the single endpoint that humanity's countries, the countries representing you, have agreed on is the single endpoint. It hasn't reduced. So it's really important to put some of these things in context, not only about their ability to do something, but their time frames to do something. The reality is, you've seen in Australia what's happened now from changing weather patterns, and the neighbors in New Zealand just in the last 6 to 12 months. That's with 1.1 degree warming from a baseline that was agreed on. We're headed for a world that's well in excess of 3 degrees on the current path we're on today. It doesn't mean it's 3 times worse. It'll be dramatically worse, because these are not linear systems that change in here. And so it is incredibly important that we focus on things that can have an impact in a time frame that is meaningful for humanity today. It's great. You might have the greatest thing since sliced bread, and it might have an impact in 2050, but the world in 2050 is not going to be the same as the world in 2030. Dramatically different. And yet, we sit there and try to do all things for everything, and that's not a good thing. So
Katrina, where do you think that balance sits between, we've heard some of the challenges, but these opportunities of things like, I think it was mentioned, of, you know, textiles, biofuels, medicinal use as well when it comes to seaweed?
So I think Steve's right. We have to come at this problem from multiple angles to look at solutions. But we also do have to have some of those radical changes. And the methane reduction is definitely one of those. But there are a number of other ways that seaweed can actually provide benefits, and not least of which is actually making sure that we look after the seaweed that's in the oceans at the moment. You might be aware I'm a bit of an advocate for seaweed now. It's only in the last few years that I've really become immersed in it and the potential and the various things that it can do. But there are so many products out there now that you can get from seaweed that can have flow-on benefits to some of these wicked problems that we're trying to resolve. For instance, there are seaweeds out there that can be sort of 30% protein. So it can be a really good protein alternative. That's up there with soy, and you're not looking at taking out arable land or fresh water to develop it. And given where our population's at, we need everything that can help us with protein. A little less cows, perhaps, but definitely everything that can help us in that space. And the seaweed is a really good alternative in that area. But I think what also Steve was alluding to is there is no silver bullet for this. We get on board with all sorts of different avenues. We have to tackle this problem from multiple directions. And I think seaweed definitely has potential in there. There are so many, I could go on ad nauseum about some of the products that you can get out of seaweed that I've become aware of and really excited about. You know, the medicinal purposes, we use seaweed, it's underpinning to agar, which is everything from ice cream to wound dressings. We have a student I was working with recently who started looking at seaweed in terms of more of that carbon sequestration. At the time, it was not quite so clear how flawed some of our thinking was, and I'm talking about 5 years ago. And he looked at it in terms of putting it into structural materials for pinboards. And in some of the testing he did, he found that it has really high fire retardant properties, certain seaweeds. Now the potential for that, if it was able to lock it down, is quite significant, but it's also significant in its own right in changing building materials. So if you're looking at something now that can be more effectively produced with a lower carbon footprint, that's a win-win. So yeah, I think we're touching the tip of the iceberg, and there's a few sort of big investments in Australia at the moment that are looking into that. There's a marine bioproduct CRC, a blue economy CRC, and there's a lot of research going on in this space at the moment. So watch this space, because there will be some really significant innovation in the next few years. It's happening now. It really is happening now. And South Australia is front and center in that. You know, the teams down here, Flinders has got the marine bioproduct CRC, is doing the really at the coalface work. And I was recently, just a couple of weeks ago, we had the International Seaweed Symposium down in Tasmania. And it's one of those opportunities you sometimes get where you think the rest of the world's moving forward. We were there going, no, Australia is front and center in this, in all of the asset, the levels of it. So you can be pretty proud of ourselves in that space.
So not to be an absolute downer then, but is there a risk that society at large is looking for a silver bullet, and if they don't get the silver bullet, bells, some, you know, governments or whoever will say, well, actually, seaweed doesn't can't save the world by itself,
no.
So let's look elsewhere. Is that a risk?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Seaweed is a tool in the toolbox. To my mind, it's probably the Swiss Army knife, but it's not the only thing, and the only thing that will save the world is us. And we have to take responsibility for what we do and what we support and how we spend our dollars. In, you know, we have to, we can save the world. See, we can help, but we can save the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I was going to mention when you were talking earlier is in terms of aquaculture and, you know, replacing proteins. So seaweed is one way that we can potentially replace proteins that come from other sources, such as mammals that are grown on land, like sheep and cows, that tend to have quite a large greenhouse gas footprint. So some of the work that we've done has shown that aquaculture in general and marine plant aquaculture specifically have quite low greenhouse gas footprints compared to the equivalent production on land. You're replacing a protein with something that has a smaller carbon footprint or greenhouse gas footprint. But there's so much variation in that. And when you start looking at how we're going to feed 8 billion people and the scale of production that we need, which we've already touched on, we have an opportunity to develop an industry and not make the same mistakes that we've made when we've been developing food production and other types of production industries in the past. And I think that that's really important, because there is a spectrum. So if you grow seaweed in the coasts, in the water, that tends to have a smaller greenhouse gas footprint than if you grow them on land in recirculating tanks. But if you grow them in the water, you get a lot more wastage, because there's seasonality, there's changes in, you know, extreme events, there's a lot more loss from the farm. And if you grow them on the land, then you have more certainty in your production, and it tends to be more efficient. And so there's all of these trade-offs and ways to, and things to consider. And it's not easy by any stretch of the imagination, but I think that there's a really big opportunity to try and move the seaweed aquaculture industry in particular in a direction that is more climate friendly than producing some of our equivalent foods on land. But there's also an opportunity for that not to be a factor that's taken into account when the industry is developing, and for it to mostly be about profit and other things, and those things not to be taken account of. And so I think it's really important that we try and keep that at the forefront. There's a greenhouse gas footprint to everything that we use in our lives, everything that we produce. And trying to keep that as small as possible as we develop this industry is really important.
Can I add one thing to that? So Alice is absolutely bang on. But I worked a lot over the years with aquaculture in various different forms. And I think the big one in here is it's like you said, it's not one size fits all for everything. So, for instance, in terms of, if you were looking at Steve's, I'll let you talk to this in a minute, Steve's area, the potential for that is significant, but to grow it in water is harder than growing it on land. But growing it on land, as you say, it comes with complexities. And we talked, you know, the social license issues of it, and perhaps even the energy costs with it. But you have to trade that off against the end game, which is a little different. A lot of our waters are around Australia are quite nutrient poor, so growing really intensive seaweed in an open water can be quite challenging. Last thing you want is, and I did hear this actually, some issues they were having in some Southeast Asia, that they were looking at adding nutrients, putting artificial lights in. Yeah, you might get more seaweed out the other end of that, but you're just creating a whole more series of issues. So you have to trade these things off. Well, I don't know, maybe the seaweed they're growing is, you know, the one that's going to be solve the problem. So it is the tension all the time between what is your end game and what's the costs of getting there. And that's, I'm sure you want to make a comment on that, Steve.
So I have two, and both, if we have any politicians here, they won't be popular. Apologies in advance. So the big shiny object that sits there, you were talking about the silver bullet, the one that has fascinated certain parts of Australia, which will not meet the goals that have been stated, is this whole space of green hydrogen. The science do not support it being a universal fuel that can be used for everything that we currently use fossil fuels for. There is no chance that will happen at any level of scale. And yet, there are hundreds of billions of dollars now being put into building ports and shipping centers. So we'll just sort of park that one there. The other one that's probably more relevant, at least in the South Australia context, the industry that just we could create. So let's talk about the scale question. For 1.5 billion cattle, we know on land with a very good commercial profit that enables people to loan us large amounts of money, not from within Australia, but to build those locations out, less than 1% of the total land area of Eyre Peninsula, and I don't mean on a coastal basis, just in totality, could supply, in the land-based systems and the way we grow it, could supply the entire world's supply. Excluding the value from the carbon credits, so to speak, that come, that is almost a $1 trillion industry. How many others you got in your back pocket here if you're a state or a federal government? It pales in comparison to just what that and the other parts of it. And you're going to grow it on land in marginal, highly high levels of unemployment, marginal land that's used for virtually nothing else in here. And you can create a completely new agricultural system that can not only be used for food and other important things, but in fact, in the shorter term, a mitigation on a methane standpoint. That is hundreds of thousands of net new jobs. That is, just from an Australia context for the 27 million cattle in here, that's somewhere like $7 billion. And yet, front page of the newspaper, well, we're going to build 8 nuclear subs. And all of the discussion and the politicization around that, it'll pale in comparison towards the economic impact. Importantly, we've already created partnerships with one Aboriginal nation, the Noongar now, in terms of how do we enhance both the cultural, the economic, yes, but the bigger interest, at least to Noongar, is on the cultural impact of being able to come back to what they've done for 50,000 years, farm the land and the ocean in a way that this can enable that to happen again. So that's part of those partnerships. We're doing the same thing with Māori groups in New Zealand and will in other parts of the world. So First Nations peace in here is an incredibly important part of not only of what we do, but what can actually happen. And just revitalizing, you know, economic centers. One of the things I think that's scary if you're over on the Eyre Peninsula is, how do you supply the workforce? You don't exist today. You don't have the housing. The infrastructure's not there. But those things can be built, as you know, that industries can grow. So economic impact from a seaweed industry broadly, but with one that has short term, it could be incredibly large here. And we'll see how that goes over the next 12 to 18 months.
A lot of you have been thinking and mulling over these ideas. We do have time for some questions. So I think we've got a couple of volunteers that have microphones, I think up the back. There's one in the middle there. So I think this gentleman here has got his hand up. So we'll head to him first in the middle. So can you just get your hand up? Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much. And while we're getting there, I'll remind you that working in Talkback Radio every day means that, unfortunately, if you don't ask a question, I'll tell you to get to the point in a very polite way.
My name is Dan Tucker. I'm a business in Adelaide. My question to the panel is, you've spoken about seaweed assisting in stopping animal burp and fart and carry on, but what's in it for the actual grower of the beef to encourage them to go and use it? Hang on, wait a minute. What's the advantage for them?
Money. They make money. The way we've structured it in a business standpoint, if the farmer were to use it, it certainly is a cost. It's actually quite very low. I won't say what it is at the moment. But there's the ability for the farmer to get a higher value for the product at farm gate because of the demand for low-carbon beef, milk, ice cream, chocolate, yogurt, cheese. Think of all the derivatives from milk that are consumed and used. There is data now that is emerging that there's an increase in productivity. So when carbon and hydrogen is not burped out as methane, it stays in the rumen and is redirected back into the thing that the rumen does, and that's create energy, and energy is the conversion into protein in that sense. And then the third is there's a value to the carbon that's reduced, and the farmer shares in that value in a way. The totality of those changes, and then one I'll come to just in a second, the totality of those three far offset any costs, so it's a value. What second principle we work on as a company, first being climate change impact at scale with urgency, the second is put money in farmers' pockets, because it doesn't work if that doesn't happen.
Okay, now we'll go to this gentleman for perseverance. He's had his hand up the whole time. We'll go to him next. Thank you.
Thank you. My interest in this is where do microplastics sit in this? Is it turning up in the plants themselves, and how does that impact into the food chain?
That's an interesting question.
Well, it is an interesting question. I'm going to have to say I'll have to take that on notice for you. I'm going to come find you, and we'll follow up on that. I don't know. Do you know, Alice?
I don't know specifically. In the case of I think because the Aspergillus is going to be lab grown, basically, so it's going to be grown in a very controlled environment, so there's much less chance there for microplastics. But in the wild, there's certainly been research done which shows that there's not microplastics necessarily in the tissues of the plants, but all of the tiny microorganisms that grow on the epiphytes, they're called, and other things that grow on plants, I know it's been shown in seagrasses, that there's microplastics incorporated into that kind of almost like a biofilm that grows on the outside of the plants.
Yeah.
So there's a risk there if we're taking things directly from the marine environment that there might be microplastics in there. There's microplastics in fish and in a lot of the other things that we already take and consume out of the marine environment.
There's certainly in every other part of the environment, so you would imagine, and many of our seaweeds, as Alice says, do have mucus, sort of slimy coatings on the outside, and that will absolutely trap microplastics.
Thanks very much. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about the actual process of how you grow and then process. And one of my questions is, if in the processing of the Aspergillus into the additive, is there an opportunity to use renewables so that it's net zero carbon processed additive?
All of our facilities will have, wherever we can, sourced renewable energy from us. In fact, the Eyre Peninsula is building one of the world's largest solar farms at the moment in close proximity to where we are. But from the operating facility standpoint, solar panels that sit on the roof and battery storage is sufficient. It doesn't draw large amounts of energy in any overt way. So yes is the answer.
G'day. I was just wondering, You mentioned some of the lessons that we should learn for growing seaweed on a large scale from what we've done in the past. Monocultures is one of the biggest problems because they are really bad for diversity. What are the things you're doing to avoid just repeating the same mistake with a different, with an algae instead of other plants, other land plants?
Yeah, that is a really good question. So I feel like we're almost at the sort of blue economy revolution is at this early, very similar stage to, we've got very similar issues to what we had in this, the terrestrial revolution, and you're absolutely right, we've got to learn from that. One of the things that I'm really passionate about is when we do this, we do not tackle how we approach bringing seaweed or agriculture of any sort into a system just as that one sector. We need to look at it at a bay-wide scale or a system-wide scale, and that's the difference. You have to know how this fits into the ecology of what you're doing in that system at the moment for two good reasons. One, you don't want the ecosystem to fail. And if you're going to do this and it's going to have the impacts we hope it will, you don't want the business or the industry to fail. And you can only do that if they look at it holistically with all of the parts together. And it is different in people's mindsets. I think we've got an advantage because on land, you put a fence around it and they think, this is mine. You can't do that in the water. It's all connected. And so there's a fundamental mindset to get people into that whatever you do, you're not doing it just on your plot. You're doing it on everybody's plot. So I can't promise it'll happen, but if that's the kind of mindset we have to come at this. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Alice, but I really do think we have to think differently, and we have to think differently as an industry, as scientists, and as government.
I'm not sure that I do have anything else to add. I think that pretty much covered it. I think that's a good point. I think there's risks, like we've seen with the aquaculture industry in some areas. You get a boundary drawn around a lease area and it is treated as if it's completely independent from everything that's going on around it. And it's not, you know, there's leaking of nutrients and damage that might occur to the surrounding area. So it's not that aquaculture has been squeaky clean, you know, in every example by any stretch of the imagination. But there's definitely a move, and it's not just from, you know, from the CRC or the Cooperative Research Centre that is now present. It's also from the Food and Agriculture Authority. So it's a global thing that there's an ecosystem-based approach to aquaculture that is, you know, being moved forward both in the research space and in the kind of the industry sectors themselves. So hopefully it's going in the right direction.
And Alice did make me think of one really other important one that I would absolutely say we have to do. We have to be not afraid to stand up and say when something's not working or something's gone wrong. And I mean that both from the point of view of the industry or the research community or even the government stepping up and saying, this is not how we thought it was going to be. We need to rethink this. But also the community to be able to step in and say, we're happy to work through this with you. Because there's often been, the way to get transparency is twofold. One, you have to get people to own and talk about issues. But you also have people to be receptive to that, to be able to say, not just to shut it down, that they actually are willing to talk about, well, what is that issue? How big is it? What are we going to do about it? How do we engage in that, solving that problem? And that's really important. That when we talk about transparency, people seem to think it's about laying everything out on the table. But I actually think it's about everybody coming to the table to be able to talk through it and find the best solution. It's not just about having it all out there. And if we can do that, then I think we've got a really good chance.
Well, on that note, we're very rapidly running out of time. But I guess to finish up, I'll ask each of you, I have to do it in about 30 seconds. But we've talked about, okay, maybe it's not the silver bullet, but there is some hope and some optimism there. For each of you, where does the hope lie? Where is the optimism? Steve, we'll start with you.
So I retired quite a few years ago, and I came out of retirement to do what I'm doing. So clearly I believe there's not only hope, but there's actually a path to a better place for humanity from a climate change impact standpoint. We're trying to do our piece within that in a way that we think has an impact in a certain period of time. And when people people ask me questions broadly around climate change, I try to give them what is the data. As a PhD trained scientist, data is a critical part of it. And so there's just an incredible amount of misinformation and disinformation. But distilled from that, we actually have, you know, we have a reasonable chance to get where we need to get to in the next decade. So.
Oh, I'm the eternal optimist. I truly believe that we all come together, we're going to do this. But the other one that I'm really inspires me in this space is the potential that there is in seaweed from so many levels, from little, you know, mum and dad farmers putting something together to the corporate, actually doing something good. And the excitement and the buzz in the sector, in the science community, even in the government around this, makes me feel really optimistic that we're backing something here that will really produce something for everyone.
I just love that there, you know, there's a lot of people here who are interested in seaweed, and there is this buzz and this excitement about seaweed, and seaweed forms these incredible natural ecosystems, and if we can leverage any of that interest to help to protect the ecosystems that we have and all of the amazing things that they do, like producing fish because they're important habitats for fish and lots of crabs and protecting our shorelines, I'm optimistic that the interest that we have in seaweed because of its ability to reduce the methane from cattle or because of its ability to produce a wound dressing kind of filters into being interested in protecting it in its natural environment as well.
Well, I think you've given us great reason for a lot of optimism into the future and a fascinating discussion. So please join me in thanking our guests.